We're going to be going through 2 weeks here. We're going to just look at the life of Joseph. So that's the next one in line. We did Jacob. I don't know if that was last week. Assume it was. So the next one in line is Joseph. This week I'm going to just walk through the life of Joseph. It's a lot of chapters in the book of Genesis, but we're just going to walk through the whole thing. Hopefully it won't be for 2 hours. But it is a lot of stuff. The story of Joseph is quite long. But he just gets this little snippet in chapter 11 of Hebrews. And we're gonna read that real quick, just so we have it in mind as we think through why maybe it was included as this snippet in Hebrews 11. So Hebrews 11:22. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. So I'm assuming that most of you guys are familiar with the story of Joseph, and probably the last thing that you would have thought of when including him in the Hall of Faith would be a little section about his bones. Seems a little odd for sure. Hey, when you go to the Exodus and you're crossing the Red Sea, make sure to grab my bones. Because Joseph's story is pretty incredible, right? I mean, if we remember some of it, and we're going to look through it today, there are a lot of very admirable things to mention from the story of Joseph. And I don't think it's because we don't really know the story of Joseph that well that we should all be like, oh, of course it's his bones, that's the thing. That's the thing that really sets Joseph apart. I think the reason that that's included in Hebrews 11 is that Hebrews 11 is very specific. There's a trajectory, a narrative that the writer of Hebrews is trying to get us to tune into, to really understand. And it's not that there are, you know, the bones is the best thing of Joseph's life. It's that the book of the chapter 11 of Hebrews is really taking us somewhere. It's a very specific thing, and we're going to look at that in a little more detail next week. But that particular thing, you guys have been talking about it, is faith. And it's a faith in a particular thing. I'm gonna give it to you for free this week. We're going to look at it in a little more detail next week. But faith, as illustrated in Hebrews 11, has a focus on someone for something. I'm sorry, I don't have any outlines. You're just going to have to pay attention. If you are writing things down, this would be a good thing to write down. Faith, as illustrated in Hebrews 11, has a focus on someone for something, that someone being Christ and that something being his coming kingdom. So keep that in mind. And I'm going to illustrate this just a little bit in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11. Let me just read a couple of these. So verse 10. So as we're walking through all of these heroes of the faith, there are these little snippets that are giving us some clues as to why this chapter 11 is so important and why we're talking about faith and the specific thing about faith that the writer of Hebrews is trying to point out. Verse 10, for he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And then 13 through 16, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. The Hebrews 11 is taking us towards that. It's going to make this transition, Hebrews 11 to Hebrews 12, of this city, this kingdom of God, that all of these heroes of the faith are having faith in a coming kingdom, that God has made a promise, right, of a land, of a kingdom, and that is being carried through all the way through to Christ, and then on into Hebrews 12, looking at us who have this cloud of witnesses. Let us not lose faith, because we're still looking for a kingdom as well. But I'm getting ahead of myself. That's next week. This week is the story of Joseph. So just to recap again, by faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. So that's where we're going. That's why Joseph is included in this hall of faith. So let's look at the story of Joseph. There's lots and lots of really good things in Joseph's story. And we're going to pick it up, if you guys want to turn there. His story starts in Genesis 37. So it goes from 37 all the way to 50. So buckle up. We're not going to read all of it, okay? Take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. I'm going to just to help us move it along a little bit, I'm going to package this little lesson up into the four stages of Joseph's life. The four stages will be his home life, his slave life, his prison life, and his king life. So Joseph at home. Genesis 37 opens up with Joseph. He's a member of a family with 12 brothers. Yikes. I came from a big family. I only have two brothers. I do have seven sisters, but I can't imagine having that many brothers. And the best part is Joseph's life is pretty great. So he has some sheep to take care of. He's got a bunch of bros to tattle on. He's a very active dreamer, and his dad likes him the best. And his dad doesn't like him the best, like in a subtle way. Like he gets him a coat that just kind of screams, "Hey, I'm daddy's favorite," right? Not just a warmer, fluffy coat, but it's got all these bright colors and stuff. And his brothers, unsurprisingly, weren't super fond of Joseph for these reasons. But their response to Joseph being the favorite is maybe a little surprising, hopefully, for all of you. So one day, all of Joseph's brothers are out tending the sheep, and dad says, "Okay, go check on your brothers, do your thing, go spy on them." And his brothers see him coming, and they say, "Let's kill him." And I hope that's not ever our response to him, but it's a little surprising that that's what they decide to do. Let's kill this guy. We have lots of brothers. We can spare, one. Thankfully, Reuben says, "Let's have mercy on him. Let's not kill him. Let's throw him in a pit." So they throw him in a pit, and thanks, bro. Then some Midianite slave traders. You can see where this story is going. It's about to get from bad to worse. Some Midianite slave traders come, and Judah says, "Hey, I got an idea. Let's not leave him in this pit. Let's sell him to these slave traders, and we'll be done with him. He won't be dead, but he'll technically kind of be dead. We'll tell his dad that he's dead, and we won't have killed him. He'll just be a slave, and who knows where? We don't care. Thanks again, bro." So they actually do that. Like, they don't kill him, but at the same time, they sell him into slavery. And I think we know this story super well, but it's important to pick these details out because they become very important later on. Your brothers just sold you into slavery. If I was him, I'd be like, "Just you wait. If I ever see your face again, it's not going to go well for you." So that would be Joseph's home life. Starts off really well, kind of gets a little bit worse towards the end. He's a slave in Egypt, right? So the Midianites take him down to Egypt, and they sell him to Potiphar. So if I'm Joseph right about now, I'm super pouty. I'm like, "Are you kidding me? Now I'm a slave in Egypt, away from my dad. I don't have my fancy coat, and now I'm a slave." But slaves don't get to pout. Slaves have to work really hard for free, for their master. Yikes. And so that's what he does. This is surprising to me. He doesn't seem to whine and complain. He works hard. Am I doing something wrong? It just does that. Well, cool. Not distracting at all. Maybe you guys are used to it. I will try and ignore it. So there's no more fancy coat. He's just in. He's just a slave in Egypt for Potiphar. Now, it's important to remember here, Potiphar is captain of the bodyguard, right, to Pharaoh. This, again, will become important. He's not just anybody's slave. He's Potiphar's slave, and Potiphar's closely connected to Pharaoh. We're going to read real quick Genesis 39, 2 through 6, just to kind of put ourselves in the passage here. And also to see that these are not just random events that are happening to Joseph. Genesis 39, 2. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he owned he put in his charge. Which is, you know, great. The Lord is with Joseph. But I think, again, don't let it be lost on you. If the Lord, like, if I'm a slave and the Lord's coming to be with me, it's to get me out of slavery. Like, I don't want to be a slave. But that's not what God's path for Joseph was at this time. It was to continue to be a slave, just a really, really good one. And again, this becomes important in that God is moving Joseph along a trajectory, not out of slavery, but through it, for a very specific purpose that's much larger than just the things that Joseph might want for his personal desires. Joseph did not want to be a slave. He wanted to be back being daddy's favorite with the fancy coat. But that wasn't, the Lord was with Joseph, but it wasn't to get him out of slavery at this time. It was to make him incredibly successful underneath as a slave in Potiphar's house. He was taking care of all of Potiphar's things and just blossoming into massive success. But he was still a slave. So things maybe are going pretty well for Joseph. At least he's successful. Sure, he's a slave, but he's doing really well. But things go from, you know, pretty good to pretty terrible because of Potiphar's wicked wife. There are many truths and principles maybe that we could draw from the story of Potiphar's wife and how, you know, don't be like that. Don't be a Potiphar's wife. But the story focuses not necessarily on Potiphar's wife or the principles that we might draw from that, but on Joseph himself and how he places himself within the confines of God's moral law, right? Potiphar's wife wants to commit adultery with Joseph. Joseph was apparently a very handsome guy, but Joseph would have absolutely nothing to do with that, even though he's far, far away from Canaan, from his father, from what may be considered the confines of God's moral law. Like, I'm out of those things, and nothing bad would happen to me. He says, no, I'm still within God's moral law. I believe in God. I believe his promises. And this is one of the reasons we're starting to see, from specifically, particularly, I would say, this initial story of Joseph's faithfulness, why he's included in the Hall of Faith, is that he's very firm in his convictions. He's very firm in what God has laid out in his law, and he believes it, he obeys it, and he follows it, regardless of what the consequences might be. But even though, as we read that story in Genesis of Joseph, and just his, he refuses these advances from Potiphar's wife, and we're clapping, we're cheering. What's the next thing that happens? Boom! He gets put in prison, right? Because Potiphar's wicked wife just twists the scenario around and lies about what Joseph did and the intentions of Joseph's heart. All of this false pretense, and Potiphar believes it and puts him in prison. And again, don't let that be lost on you. Just because you have tremendous spiritual or moral victories doesn't gain you much in the eyes of the world, right? Potiphar won this tremendous spiritual victory, and he ends up in prison. And you thought being a slave was bad. Try being a prisoner. So we need to remember those things that, again, just because we have spiritual victories doesn't mean we earn much in the eyes of the world, that all of a sudden things are going to go great for us. You may go from a really good spot to a really poor spot. I think this maybe is most applicable in our workplaces, when we get jobs or when we have friends and they say, come along with us, right? We see that in the book of Proverbs a lot. Come along with us. We'll go get some innocent man's blood. Whatever that might look like for you in your life, don't go along with them. Not because it's going to go super well with you in the world if you don't, but because God has said so. God has said, you cannot do that. You must not do that. And regardless of the consequences, we follow through. We do what is right, even if it ends us, in this case, in prison. So that would be Joseph's slave life. Now we get into Joseph's prison life. This isn't getting a lot better for Joseph. He just keeps going down the hill, it would seem. I think it's important, again, though, to realize that the Lord is still working, right? So this isn't just any prison. This is the prison where Pharaoh's prisoners were placed, because being, again, Potiphar's slave, he gets put in Potiphar's prison, and that is a prison where all of Pharaoh's slaves and prisoners get put. There are lots of prisons in Egypt, but this is a very specific prison. And we'll see again, that becomes very important later on. So keep that in mind. We're going to read real quick. So this is going to be Joseph in prison. We see again, the Lord's going to show up. And he's going to, you know, in the New Testament where Peter's in prison and the earthquake happens and the gates fly open, right? That's probably what's going to happen here. We'll read in chapter 39, 21 through 23. But the Lord was with Joseph. So Joseph's in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. The chief jailer committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in jail so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. Whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. And you kind of got to be like, he's still in prison though. Right? The Lord's kindness was shown to Joseph, but he's still a prisoner. He's still in jail. He's just doing really well in prison. He's getting to take care of all these prisoners. But at the end of the day, Joseph's still a prisoner. Joseph's still in jail. And I don't know about you, but I think I would struggle a little bit with God calling himself kind in that scenario, because a lot of times, again, we may think of God's kindness as just towards me, and there's things that I want, and if I don't get them, God's not kind. Now, we know that's not true, but I think sometimes that's the way we think about it, that God's not kind if he doesn't give me what I want, and how could God call himself kind when I'm still a prisoner? Yeah, maybe I'm doing well, but I'm still in prison. We know Joseph's story. There's something much bigger going on behind the scenes. We need to keep that in mind again in our lives when we struggle, when we may wrestle with God's kindness, to realize that God does big things with lots of people. We need to allow our thoughts to be moved in that way to understand that God does bigger things than just make us feel well and get us out of prisons. He's doing something much larger. God is always kind, even if that kindness leaves you in prison. So Joseph's doing well. He's in charge of all the prisoners, but still in prison. But we get some dreams, right? So there's two prisoners there that were sent there from Pharaoh's house. They apparently did something that Pharaoh didn't like, and they end up in prison. They have dreams, and Joseph interprets those dreams. He says to the cupbearer, you're going to get out of prison and go get to be, do the cupbearer thing for Pharaoh. And to the baker, you get your head cut off. But he interprets both those dreams, and both of those things happen. And lest we think that Joseph's totally chill and very okay with being a prisoner, we'll read 40, Genesis 40, 14 through 15. So he's talking that he just interpreted the dream for the cupbearer. And Joseph knows, hey, this guy is going to go from this prison back to Pharaoh's house. I'm going to ask him to do something for me. 14. Only keep me in mind when it goes well with you, and please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this house. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing. They should have put me into the dungeons. He didn't want to be in prison. He wanted to get out. And he asked, like, he just did this tremendous favor of interpreting this dream for this cupbearer. And now they're like, there's this opportunity. Maybe I can get out of prison. He didn't want to be in prison. There's something wrong with him not wanting to be in prison, and so he sees this opportunity to get out of prison. And we're like, yes, finally, there's this opportunity that he gets out. But we read down to 23, yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph but forgot him. And we're like, come on, are you kidding me? How could you forget him? Just mention him to Pharaoh, get him out of prison. He said he was one of the Hebrews. Just send him back to his papa. This whole thing can be over. Doesn't go that way, though, which is unfortunate, or so we think. But that, again, was not God's way to get Joseph out of prison. It was through the cupbearer's dream. It was through Pharaoh's dream, because now it's Pharaoh's turn to have a dream. And his one's pretty crazy. He's got 7 fat cows and 7 ears of corn or grain things. And they're huge, plump, very nice and healthy, fantastic. If you were a farmer, you'd be like, yes, I've done it. I've grown the best corns and cows. And then there are 7 other cows and corns that are scrawny and awful and disgusting, and they eat the big cows and the big corns. And if you're Pharaoh, you're like, what was that? And so, this is exactly what Pharaoh says. He's like, can someone please interpret this for me? And there's nobody that's found who can do this, interpret the dream. Oh, but maybe there is. Well, we get back to our cupbearer friend. In 41:33, now, as for, 41:33, I think that's the right one, hold on. Oh, I messed up. 41:9. Then the chief cupbearer spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I would make mention today of my own offenses, you think? Pharaoh was furious with his servants, and he put me in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard, both me and the chief baker. We had a dream the same night. He and I, each of us, dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now a Hebrew youth was with us there, a servant of the captain of the bodyguard, and we related them, the dreams, to him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each his own, he interpreted according to his own dreams, and just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, but the other guy, he hung. Thank you, Mr. Cupbearer. It's about time you remembered, but it's in this perfect moment, right? Like, the Lord could have put it in the chief cupbearer's mind to remember a while ago, but who knows what would have happened. This was the specific moment that Pharaoh needed an interpreter for his dream, and lo and behold, there's this Joseph guy, this youth, this Hebrew youth who might be of service. And so Joseph, they bring Joseph out of prison. I think this is kind of interesting. In 41, what I was trying to read before, 14 through 16, then Pharaoh sent and called for Joseph, and they hurriedly brought him out of the dungeon. And when he had shaved himself and changed his clothes, he came to Pharaoh. He was a nasty man when he came out of the dungeon. He had to shave himself, clean himself up, put on some nice clothes before he could go to Pharaoh. Don't think the dungeons were nice places. This is not where Joseph wanted to be. But now was the time that he was going to be pulled out of the dungeon and put right before Pharaoh for a specific purpose to interpret the dream. And what was the interpretation of the dream but that there's going to be a 7 years of plenty, right? That's what the great big fat cows were. But then also right after those 7 years of plenty comes 7 years of famine, and it's going to swallow up. And we're not even going to remember that there were 7 years of goodness because of the horrible famine that's coming. I mean, once the famine strikes, it just again and again, the famine was severe in all the land. It was a horrible famine, which again is going to have a very specific purpose. If there's nothing else you really necessarily get from this, it's that God is working in a very specific way for a very specific purpose in every little detail. And that detail involves individual lives. Joseph's life, the cupbearer's life, Pharaoh's life, but he's moving all of these stories together to accomplish a very specific purpose, and we will see what that is closer to the end. But right now, Joseph is interpreting the dream, and in 41:33 through 44, I'm just going to read that. So Joseph interprets his dream. There's going to be some crazy famine, but there's 7 years of plenty. So what do we need to do? If there's going to be 7 years of horrible famine, but before that, 7 years of tremendous plenty, we need to get ready for the famine. We need to take advantage of those 7 years of plenty. Joseph knows this, and he says in 41:33, "Now let Pharaoh look for a man discerning and wise, and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh take action to appoint overseers in charge of the land, and let him exact a fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 years of abundance. Then let them gather all the food of these good years that are coming and store up the grain for food in the cities under Pharaoh's authority, and let them guard it. Let the food become as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which will occur in the land of Egypt, so that the land will not perish during the famine." Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Then Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this, in whom is such a divine spirit?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold necklace around his neck. He had him ride in his second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee." And he set him over the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Wow, like we transition from slave to prisoner to this king status that that Joseph gets because of Pharaoh. But I think it's worth noticing, maybe calling back a little bit to Pharaoh, to Joseph's home life. The Joseph who was spying on his brothers and taking care of sheep wasn't this Joseph. Like, he had to go through Potiphar's house. He had to go through prison so that he could look at this famine that was coming and say, "I know how to handle this. I know how to take care of it. I've been taking care of Potiphar's house for years, and I've grown. I've seen how to manage this thing and turn it into something great. I've been through prison, and I understand how to deal with people and to get things to a certain place where they're better, to where they're profitable, to where we can take something good and make it better." All of these years of preparation that we would have said, and Joseph would have said as well, "Just get me out of here. I want to go back to my dad, back to my nice coats." But he's been going through all of this preparation, all of this work, all of this struggle, so that when he comes to Pharaoh, he has a plan that's a good plan. Pharaoh recognizes it as a good plan and says, "Okay, you do it. You be in charge." We need to remember that again. We don't just want to get out of those things that are challenging and difficult for us, but that the Lord is working in our circumstances, in our situations, in the places where we are to prepare us for what he has in the future. And it may not, we have to again look beyond just ourselves and just our specifics and say that God is doing something very large. God has a big purpose and a big plan, and he's moving in many ways, and I'm a piece of that. I'm a part of that, and I need to be willing, wherever I am in life, to be being prepared, even if it's difficult, even if it's challenging, that God is working, and I need to see it that way and be willing to put myself underneath the challenge so that I'm better able to bear up under what may come in the future, whether or not that's as a slave in prison or as, in this case, the king. And so Joseph starts preparing, and he does incredibly well. He's just stockpiling all of this stuff, loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads and loads of food, probably lots and lots of fat cows and corn, until he stops counting. There's just so much of it. And then the famine comes, and as we've already seen and prepared ourselves for, it's a awful famine. It's not just Egypt, it's the whole world. And because there's this famine everywhere. But the people who prepared, who are ready for it, was wherever Joseph was, right? So there's lots and lots of food in Egypt because that's where Joseph was preparing all of it. So all the world's like, we're going to starve to death. But I've heard that there's a place where we might be able to find some food if we pay for it, Egypt. Let's go down to Egypt. And so everybody's going to Egypt and buying food. And hey, guess who else is coming? Joseph's brothers. Because Jacob's back up in Hebrew land in Canaan, and he's getting hungry. So he tells the brothers, there's food in Egypt. Take some money and go buy us some food. So the 12 brothers say, cool, let's go down to Egypt. We need to remember that, as far as they're aware, Joseph's dead. So they have no idea at all. It's always a little bit surprising. I wonder how much different, because the brothers come down to Egypt, they get in front of Joseph, and they just have no idea that it's Joseph. So I don't know if it was prison to change the way he looked, if he was wearing all kinds of Egyptian stuff, but they had no idea. But Joseph knew. Joseph looked at him, he's like, that's my brothers, right? And at this point, I'm like, I'm kind of king of Egypt. Whack. It's your turn. Hey, I got a prison for you. He doesn't do that. We know he doesn't do that, but don't just like, of course he didn't do that. I think some of us might have, or at least we would have been like, kind of holding a grudge. But Joseph's starting to get it now, right? As he's gone through all of these stages, as the famine comes, he's got in the back of his mind, this is crazy. I was sold into slavery. I was put in Potiphar's house. I end up in prison. Now here I am, is like, this is crazy. My life has been absolutely bonkers. But I'm starting to see the pattern that God has moved it. Like there's a terrible famine in the land. What would have happened if there had been no preparation? We all would have starved. My family would have starved. My dad would have starved because this famine was coming. But I've been put here to prepare for this famine, and now my brothers are coming. I have to recognize, as Joseph, that this is from God. This is not from just some random chance thing that happened, and now I can get the chance to take revenge on my brothers. He sees the opportunity like God has done this. Like, sure, my brothers did this thing, this terrible, wicked thing to me, but all along it's been God who's been doing this. And I think we would do well to remember that in our own lives when we have opportunity to get revenge, when we have opportunity to speak unkindly to others who maybe wronged us, when the tables turn, right? That's the phrase that gets used, that we don't use that as an opportunity to get revenge, but we've been paying attention to what God's been doing, and we recognize that even though men may have meant this for evil, God meant it for good. And we see that. We see that in Joseph. 45, so continuing on, Genesis 45, 1 through 8. So this is this is Joseph. So again, his brothers didn't recognize him. So they have this kind of like back and forth where they come down, they go back, and then the brothers come back again. And Joseph's, I think he's been testing them to see like what the deal is. Like he wants to see his brother Benjamin. And so they bring Benjamin back down. And this time, seeing Benjamin, Joseph is ready finally to reveal himself to say, ta-da, I'm your brother that you sold into slavery. And we see that in 45, 1 through 8. Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, have everyone go out from me. So there was no man with him when Joseph made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard it and the household of Pharaoh heard it. Then Joseph, crying pretty loud. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? But his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. I imagine so. This guy's going to whack us. Then Joseph said to his brothers, please come closer to me. And they came closer. And he said, I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now do not be grieved or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, but there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now, therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God. And he has made me a father to Pharaoh and Lord of all his household and ruler over the land of Egypt. That's a incredibly mature perspective to have. And maybe if I was going to pick, again, if we come back to Hebrews 11 a bit, that may have been the thing that I would include. But I think, again, we need to remember that Hebrews 11 has a different purpose than just picking out great people and maybe highlighting the best thing in their life. Hebrews 11 is for something a little bit different. We'll, again, get into that next week. But there are many emulatable things from Joseph's life, and this is one in particular that I would like us to remember, that Joseph had a forgiving heart, but it wasn't just overlooking offense. He saw God at work. He saw the things that God was doing through his life for his purposes, and that Joseph was a piece of that, and he didn't take opportunity, even though he could have, to take revenge on his brothers for selling him into slavery. We'll jump ahead just a little bit to see, again, Joseph does the same thing. We get another glimpse into the goodness of Joseph's heart. So this is after, we're going to get into it in a minute, but all of Joseph's brothers and his dad will come down to Egypt, but then eventually Jacob, Joseph's dad, dies. And then again, all of his brothers are like, now that dad's dead, Joseph's going to kill us. They were terrified. They really, really thought Joseph's going to take revenge. There's no way. There's no way that a man as powerful as him and the thing that we did to him, that he will not take revenge on us. There's just no way. They're terrified of it. But again, we'll see here, Genesis 50, in 19 through 21, they actually make up a story. So backing up just a little bit, they make up a story of what their dad had said. So 15, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged us before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father.' And Joseph wept when they spoke to him." I think because he's like, "Do you not? We've been over this. I was going to kill you, I'd kill you. Don't make up stories. It's going to be fine. Like, God has done this thing." He wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." But Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in God's place? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good in order to bring about this present result, to preserve many people alive. So therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. We see that word a bit in the story of Joseph, kindly, that God was kind to Joseph in prison, and here that Joseph was kind to his brothers. Kindness isn't just getting what we want or when someone gives us what we want, but seeing that bigger purpose. Seeing the purposes of God in whatever situation we're in, whether we can clearly see them at the moment or not, having faith that God is good and that what we're going through, he has a purpose and a plan, and it is good, we need to believe that. So anyway, backing up again, so Joseph's brother reveals himself to his brothers. He says, "Hey, these 2 years of famine have been really bad, but guess what? There's 5 more years of this famine. It really isn't practical for you to just keep coming back and forth, back and forth, back and forth to get food. How about you go back to Jacob and gather up your family and come down into Egypt? We're gonna gather up your family, and we'll all move down to Egypt. It'll be grand. We'll all be together again." This seems like a fantastic plan, and this is actually here the entire purpose of the story of Joseph. Is getting the nation of Israel, right? So there had been a promise of God that we're all familiar with to make of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob a great nation. There were just going to be loads and loads and loads of people. But we see when this nation comes from Canaan down to Egypt, There are 70 people, and I don't know about you, but 70 is not a nation. It's not. And they've had a couple generations, but there's only 70 people. That's nowhere near a nation. But it's hard to grow a nation when you're in Canaan and there's all of these other nations around you that as soon as they start to see you growing, they're like, aha, we're going to smack them and take all their stuff. And now they're not a nation anymore. So there's this, how do we grow a nation in Canaan when it's not conducive to that? That's not a good place for that. Well, you bring them down into the most powerful nation on the planet at the time, Egypt, and you grow them in Egypt into a massive nation. So the whole point of the story isn't just, hey, great story about Joseph. There's a purpose. God has made a promise to grow the nation of Israel into a massive amount of people. Right now, it's 70 people. And so the purposes of God is to grow this nation. And so he gets through Joseph, through the famine, this family of people to come down into Egypt, where they will have safety and the opportunity to grow into a massive nation. If we skip forward, gave a lesson probably about a month ago at one of the Nerf Wars on the crossing of the Red Sea. Estimates are, from that number that is given of the men who left Egypt, right? We know the story that what happened to them in Egypt. They became a great nation, massive amounts of people, and Egypt looks at them and says, like, there are a lot of people. We should probably make them into slaves because, A, there's a lot of people, so we get a lot of slaves, and B, if they keep growing, they're going to take us over. So the Egyptians will put them into slavery. They go through all these plagues. Moses shows up, and they leave. And when they leave, they're roughly 3 million people. They go from 70 to about 3 million people, which is bananas, but that's the whole point. That's the whole point of again, taking them down into Egypt so they can grow into a great nation. And yet, the promise was a great nation in the promised land. And so now they're in Egypt. They're going to become a great nation. This is the point of the story of Joseph, that they get down there and they begin to grow. But the promise was for a great nation in the promised land. And Joseph knows this. Jacob knows this. And this is what Joseph was included for in the book, chapter 11 of Hebrews. He knows that a partially fulfilled promise is not a fulfillment. If they're a great nation in Egypt, that's not a fulfillment. That's not a full fulfillment. Yeah, they're a nation, but they need to be in the promised land. And Joseph knows, okay, we're going to come into Egypt. You guys all come down here. We'll survive this famine. We're going to be in Egypt, and that's unfortunate. But I know, because God has promised, we're going to go back. And I'm so confident in that I'm going to make you swear to me that when you leave Egypt and you go back to the promised land, you take my bones with you. Because I am positive, I am assured that God has made a promise that we will be a great nation in the promised land. Right now, we're neither, and I'm going to die having not seen either, but I know that God, who has made a promise that this will happen, will see it through. I won't be alive to see it. Somebody will be. And so you keep telling people down through the generation until this happens, when you leave and you go back to Canaan, you get my bones and you take them up. And that's what he's remembered for in Hebrews 11. It's like the story of Joseph is fantastic. There's so many things in it that we can emulate and look to and be encouraged in. I mean, we've covered a lot of those things. But ultimately, and we will look more in detail next week, but the thing that Joseph is remembered for, and the thing I think that really identified his life, is just a firm conviction that when God makes a promise, he will see it through. Even if I don't see it right now, even if I don't get it, even if I'm in prison and I don't want to be here, God has made a promise. And at some point, he will fulfill it. And that's something that we too must emulate, because God has made promises to us as well. And regardless of where we are right now, whether we're doing really well at home, whether we're a slave, whether we're in prison, whatever those things, those challenges, those difficulties may look like for you, God has made you promises, and he will see them through. Even if you don't live to see them, any promise that God has made to his people, he will see it through. And we can have that confidence, that firm assurance that God will see his promises through, just like Joseph did. in all of the challenges that he had. So swinging back around to the beginning a little bit, he had a focus. Joseph had a focus on someone for something, that someone being God, and that something being the nation of Israel in the Promised Land, that there would be a nation, and it would be in the Promised Land. Neither of those things he saw happen in his life, but he played a huge role in making that happen through his faithfulness, through all the challenges, provided the opportunity for those 70 people to get down into Egypt where they were safe, where they could grow, and then through Moses, you know, we're going to see Hebrews 11 is bringing us along this journey of how God grew the nation of Israel into a nation, into the Promised Land, and how that will continue on even to today as we look forward to a time when we will be with Christ in his kingdom, in his eternal heavenly kingdom forever. But that focus, that's the thing I would like us to take away from today, that we should have a focus on someone for something, that being, that's faith, right? That assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen, a focus on someone for something. It's not a blind faith. It's a faith that both looks at a person, Christ, for something specific, because he has made specific promises to us, and we can hang on to those promises. So let us go and do likewise. For God has made us promises, well, we can live in faith that he will see them fulfilled regardless of how the day may find us, whether we're at home as slaves, as prisoners, or as kings. Let's pray. Dear Father, I thank you for today. I thank you for the opportunity to be encouraged through the truth of your word, from seeing in the book of Hebrews all of these stories of faithful men in the Old Testament from many, many, many years ago, but how they had a faith in the same God that we are to have faith in, that just as you made promises to them and they based their whole lives in assurance of what to do in their lives on those promises, that we can have that same faith too, that you've made promises to us and we too can hang on to those. I pray that we would, that we can see your hand at work, that you would strengthen and encourage our hearts, and that we might be faithful, that we might stay the course and not lose heart, but that just like the men and women of old in the Old Testament, that we would maintain and have a faith firmly established, firmly built up in who you are as a promise-keeping God, and that we could go forward in our lives with a firm conviction that as you have promised, you will do, regardless of the circumstances or situations that we find ourselves in, that we can have a bigger vision than where we find ourselves, that you make promises and you keep them. And I pray these things in Jesus' name, amen.